I want to talk about something that is important to a lot of motorcyclists, and that is engine sound. Because motorcycles have every different number of cylinders that you can imagine, up to generally six as a maximum, singles, twins, triples, fours, at least a couple of sixes. BMW makes one, Honda makes one, the Goldwing 1500. Single cylinder engine, generally speaking, an uninteresting sound, because it sounds like a lawnmower. When you make a twin, the British twins fired at 360 degrees, which meant that they had an even 360 degree firing order. Every revolution they fired, and they made a kind of droning sound. Lovers of British twins like that sound. Possibly a more interesting sound is made when you move those cylinders apart to make a V-twin. Now you have a difference in the firing order, so that there is a quiet time, then a cylinder fires, then a shorter quiet time, and another cylinder fires, giving a kind of syncopated da-dit, da-dit, which is why V-twins have a sort of more like a V8 sound, and is a more interesting sound to listen to. Clearly, the closer the V angle comes to zero, the more it sounds like a British twin. And out at 90 degrees, there's Ducati, who have chosen that 90 degree angle because it allows their engine to be self-balancing for primary shaking force. But then we get to the triple. Triples usually have their crank pins at 120 degrees, and they produce a wonderful musical sound, which I have enjoyed since the first time I heard the Kawasaki H1 in 1969. Then we get to the very popular four-cylinder bikes. Most of them have a so-called flat crankshaft with its crank pins at 180 degrees, so that the cylinders in the middle, the number two and number three cylinder at top dead center, when number one and number four are bottom dead center. As a result, the engine fires twice per revolution, and the firing interval is always the same. So on a high revving engine, a flat crank four produces the famous GSXR screech. Yamaha, after their experience with the M1 road race bike, which was converted to 90 degree crank pins for the 2004 season, rider Valentino Rossi, who was hired by Yamaha newly that year, liked the 90 degree crank pin angle better than he liked the 180, so that's what he got. But in terms of sound, like a V-twin differs from a parallel twin, a 90 degree crank pin inline four cylinder makes a throatier, more V8-like sound, and does not produce GSXR screech. So that's an interesting difference. And then you have BMW's Touring 6, which is one of the smoothest engines that there is. And it also produces a very smooth sound, just like that of a Jaguar inline six or a Merlin V12 of World War II. They all have a very similar, quite civilized purr. And then there's the Honda Goldwing, which is a flat six. It has three cylinders this way and three cylinders this way. The aim of this is that you have enough cylinders that they can cancel each other's shaking force, leaving the engine smooth enough for touring. Engine sound also has a component that is Se
It's Jacinto. If you hear this message, I'm not coming. I'm not coming if you hear this message. I can't come today. When you hear this message, I can't come. When you hear this message, don't wait for me. I'm not coming. Don't wait for me. Don't wait today.
So we're joined by Ona Lindquist now with the three of us and still tongue in cheek. Ona Lindquist is a practicing psychoanalyst, also a licensed clinical social worker, and to our great interest, accompanying that, entangled with that, she is a poet and a visual artist. In the 80s, in the late 80s, she had done a project called Objet Venda, which was by Vendana, sorry, which were a set of vending machines that sort of first, I think the first one emerged in at the Quad Cinema in downtown, and then some galleries around New York, and then department stores in Japan were asking for them. And soon there were, I can't remember how many total, it was like 11 or so that were around the U.S. and around the world. And by 1989, she had stopped that project. We'll get into talking about that a little bit, but she had sold 30,000 artworks through these vending machines. It had, I think, fulfilled a voice. And Ona moved on to change her voice and think about her voice through poetry, but also in studying as a psychoanalyst, psychotherapist. So we're really happy to have her here today to continue and maybe further define, embellish, broaden our discussion of Hockett by thinking through some of her writing from a piece called Swimming in Space, which she just shared a little part of, and we're going to also start off with that again, I think, in a second. To give you just some background on Swimming in Space without much background as an introduction, which Ona will give herself, Swimming in Space was done in 2000, written in 2014. Much earlier, sorry. Ona, tell me.
Maybe 2013.
She shared it at the 17th International Forum of Psychoanalysis in Lithuania, the International Society of Psychological and Social Approaches to Psychosis in 2014 in New York. And where I first encountered it was at an intimate seminar, Revisualizing Trauma, Creativity and Transformation Committee of the New York Society of Clinical Social Work in 2015. I think that was the beginning of 2015. That's when I first heard this piece and started to talk to Ona, I think, a little bit more closely about her work and it in relationship to her practice. But just maybe a recap on those places. What's also really exciting to share some of this with us today is that I think up until now, most of the venues that you have shared this in have been within the psychoanalytic or social work community, and not so much necessarily in community of poets or in community of artists. Is that right?
Yes, this is the first time, yes.
Great.
Moving out of that community.
In full broadcast.
Although I would say that a lot of the people I've presented to, aside from being psychoanalysts or psychotherapists, were also artists and poets.
a lot of the people that you did present to. Do you have? I mean, I think we're gonna keep sort of cycling in and out of questions as we dip into different parts of this piece, Swimming in Space. I want to fragments of a therapy in verse, but sort of dipping into that in particular, this idea of or just the terrains within which you've spoken about it. I'm curious to what extent, in sharing it with other psychoanalysts or other psychotherapists or other social workers, if some of them have come to you with similar practices that go alongside their practice of psychotherapy. Maybe that's a question to hold on to, because I imagine our listeners don't really necessarily know what it is that we're talking about, this thing swimming in space that we're kind of circling around. So maybe we start off by, can we return to that first sort of prefacing It's Jacinto text, and maybe before reading it again, could you share with us a little bit of the context of what this is?
The context is very simple. I was in my office one day waiting for Jacinto to come to a session, and I get a message on my voicemail.
So Jacinto was a patient?
Yes.
Okay.
It's Jacinto. If you hear this message, I'm not coming. I'm not coming if you hear this message. I can't come today. When you hear this message, I can't come. When you hear this message, don't wait for me. I'm not coming. Don't wait for me. Don't wait today.
This is very Gertrude Stein, actually.
I'm curious from conversations that we've had in the past, especially the other day when Aaron and I were speaking to you about, I think it may be in reaction to that very piece, if you could speak a little bit about rhythm, and the kind of, I mean, like Emma's saying, Gertrude Stein, this kind of rhythm and repetition, which might maybe get us to talking about Gertrude Stein, but more particularly to that, you know, what kind of relationship do you think is built with that rhythm that you're rehearsing in text there?
It wasn't until because of the diagnosis of this particular patient as a schizophrenic patient, it wasn't until I could hear the way he talked to me in verse, with pacing, with rhythm, that I could actually stay with the material that he was talking about. And so this literally is the message.
But this is a voicemail that he's he's telling you he's not going to be there.
Right.
So at the same time, it's something about they're like the only almost that the only presence that will be there and is there is actually the rhythm of his voice.
Well, he certainly left a lot of rhythm in that message. And actually, in thinking about Jacinto, it was even amazing that he left a message at all and just didn't show up. So that was progress.
Should we turn to... Do you have some...
Wanted to ask about hearing voices and the auditory hallucination that is present to schizophrenics, and whether that surfaced much.
When you began that question, I thought it was me who was hearing the voices finally in order to hear Jacinto. You know, I'd be very cautious about how I would think about that, because I believe that the way he spoke to me was coming from the different states of being, the different ways he is in the world. And not so much that he was hearing voices, but that he was remembering himself. And it often came out in very unintegrated ways, mm. but they were as real. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that, that paranoid schizophrenics really? Don't have auditory hallucinations.
We
but
all
I,
do, yeah.
we all, but I. That's not how I. Yeah. I thought about him.
Is that? Would you say? Oh no, that's particular to thinking about this patient, or more broadly of how you think about that kind of vocal presence, or ways like you say ways with like the it's almost a way of coordinating different ways of being. All of which were happening, and that he was transitioning in and out of. I mean, I don't think that we have to get like so into deep into this particular patient, just without necessarily staying with what you're giving us in this written text. So hold us back whenever, if we are diving in the wrong direction.
I think it's very specific to each person I work with how I hear what they say. Mm.
Yeah, and that sounds like it's something that's, you know, has to be done on a very, you know, person-to-person basis, and that there isn't a sort of universal language that, I mean, or yeah, relationship that I don't know how to articulate this, that you have to develop trust on a one-on-one basis, and that there's a lot of communication in that. It sounds like communicating with Jacinto was like very much something that had to be learned, and that for him there was a lot of content in how he was in the rhythm and almost like the lyricism of what he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know if I would last with Jacinto, you know, and it was maybe 2 months into our time together when it just all of a sudden it hit me that the repetitions and the, you know, the perseverating and the, you know, over and over again was all of a sudden I heard it as poetry, and I became interested in a whole different direction. You know, not so much about him being a patient who had an illness, but somebody who had some really interesting ways of connecting language.
Yeah, like in the traditional structure of language, if you were to judge what he was saying by that, it wouldn't make sense. But if you pause to, if you take time to, I guess, learn the patterns of what things meant for him, then you would understand, I guess, and that's what I'm taking away from our discussion the other day, that there was an entirely different meaning to the words he was and how he was using them and how they came out.
Which is, you know, isn't that the most interesting thing about reading poetry? How, or reading anything interesting, how people put words together, what's next to each other, what, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. It gives you an opportunity to think about different definitions and different ways of hearing things.
Before asking you to read session X, if that's okay, even before the introduction, I just want to read something else from here, which is, I think, on the topic of what you just said, the simplicity of the vocabulary, the repetition, the alliteration, all get closer to a more basic and most difficult emotions. And it's an epigraph, and you have marked here, it's, in parentheses, Lydia Davis, which is just before what we heard before, which ends, it's Jacinto. I want to come back to that at a certain point in thinking about kind of authorship and ownership of voice in different ways. But maybe to get a little bit closer to the material, a little bit more intimate to the material, can we hear you read Session X, please?
Okay. Session X, the nuisance. I don't want to live there anymore. Can you help Jacinto find another place to stay. They say, I'm a nuisance, go away. I ask them to help. They say, I'm a nuisance, go away. I lend them money. I want my money back. They don't pay me back. Nobody helps me get my money back. Can you help Jacinto get his money back? Jacinto will never lend his money again. Jacinto will never lend his money. Can you help me get my money back? They say I am a nuisance. Go away. Jacinto, I say, who are they? They borrow my money and don't pay me back. They say, go away. I am a nuisance, they say. They bang my door and run away. Who is the nuisance, Jacinto, I say. Jacinto says, they stole my coat. I want my coat back. Can you help Jacinto get his coat back? I need to go on eBay and find my coat. Can you help me go on eBay? I need to find my coat on eBay, like the one they stole. They say, I'm a nuisance. Go away. Jacinto makes me want to go away, but I say, Jacinto, I am here to stay. Can you stay with what I say? Jacinto says, I can't come back next week. I need to find my coat on eBay. My friend said, look on eBay. Can you help me find my coat on eBay? No, I say, unlike your friend, I doubt your stolen coat is on eBay. Jacinto, I say, our time is up today. It's time to go. I say, you need to go. Jacinto gets up to go, but doesn't go. Can you help me get my money back? He doesn't forget. I don't know, Jacinto. He feels like a nuisance. He won't go. I ask him to go, but he can't get out. Jacinto is stuck in Jacinto. Jacinto can't get out, and I can't get in to help him out. I can't get Jacinto out. Jacinto is stuck in Jacinto. He won't go. Jacinto, I say, if you go, you can come back. If you don't go, how can you come back? He doesn't know if he can come back. I know I can't help him get his coat back. Jacinto has 3 coats on his back and comes each week with a large valise in case he finds his coat on eBay.
So you were saying that you could interpret things about Jacinto, about what and understand what he was saying through certain gestures, like repetition you were mentioning. What other sort of I don't know, communicative poetic gestures, and by that I mean, like, were there any other, did he rhyme or, you know, repeat words? Or I'm sort of interested in the other forms that his communication and these sort of like formal ways of speaking took form.
Well, I think mostly I stayed very, very close to his words. I used his words. So I think he could hear me in that way. You know, it's not... I mean, I think that was actually something that really opened up for us a way to go back and forth. I can't say it opened up a dialogue, but it just opened up a pathway.
What opened up that pathway?
The idea that I would use his very words back to him, you know, either rearranging them or putting them in the form of a question, or, you know, I mean, and even though they seemed so out in left field, I think the repetition of them began to express, you know, his fear and anxiety, and you know, there were a lot of feelings in the simplicity of the language and the repetitiveness of the language, and if I could feed them back in an honest and truthful way. Like, no, I can't help you get your coat back. You know, I don't think it's on eBay, even though he was honestly told this, and, you know, and he had an idea that this is what you do. So I think through honesty and using his language to speak to him in.
And in that way, I'm curious how, in this text as a text, when you know, how you engaged with it from moving from your yellow pad that you have always commented on and have always around you, and when you're in session have on your lap and are writing, and I'm wondering how it makes the jump from there to a written thing, because there's within that question is sort of nested what something that you had just said, which is that you use his words, you're using his words to speak to him, right? And there are these moments where you say, who's they? I say, who's they? Or you say, Jacinto, I say. And that voice, I'm kind of curious at what point it comes in. Is it something that you would see as something that comes in on your yellow pad, as in session? Or is it something that comes in revisiting what became the not only the document but a very active document, almost a script of speaking back to him, this yellow pad, when you're revisiting this thing, when it becomes a text form? I mean, maybe that's thinking back to a very particular moment when you first shared this material or had started to compose it in a way that you could share in Lithuania, which I think was the first place that you did.
Mm-hmm. Again, it was, you know, I'm thinking it was just sort of a magical moment for me, because several months had gone by where my notes were pretty fragmented and I couldn't decipher them. They didn't hold any particular depth, you know, I didn't know. And then, I mean, it really did occur to me all at once. And maybe it has to do with the fact that in 2002, when I went back into my second analysis, I started reading and writing poetry. And I think that's what enabled me to find this moment. Prior to that, I don't know if I would have ever found a way in. And I will say that he didn't stay with very many therapists.
Before you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
or I should say, a lot of therapists didn't stay with him.
And I think that's an interesting way of putting it. I mean, so you think that shift was in, at least how I've heard you say it, that like you know, things weren't unfolding as they would in a session, but they were unraveling, right? Mm-hmm. And that suddenly some new kind of math, as you put in certain places, some new algorithm sort of came in to aid, as you said, when you were starting to write and read poetry, start to come in as an almost an informant of way to look at this in a very formally, very different way. There's kind of two places I could go with that. One, or that we could go with that. One being, I would be very curious to know, I'd be very curious to know what that meant in terms of looking down at a text that you had written. Did it mean seeing it formally different, or does it mean looking at it and seeing just the sound? Or was it so entwined with hearing, as maybe you think of poetry to be, that looking at your yellow notebook was were a set of sounds, you know? Yet maybe something else to sort of plug into that question, if it's clear in any way. Maybe this makes it a little bit more ambiguous. But the other day from our conversation, I think I'd picked up on something you had said, the sound shape of a relationship.
The shape of sound.
The shape of sound, but then that kind of growing as the idea of the sound shape of a relationship itself. And if we can look at a yellow pad, or if we can look at any writing, hand or typed, in any kind of font, as having its kind of personality in its form, it also has a sound in its form. And I wonder if these, I mean, the yellow pad is sort of stuck in my head because I see it here at the desk also, but it's stuck in my head as this sort of, maybe also this marker of a shift of your perception of seeing this document of your communication with someone as a score maybe, or as a piece of sound itself. Tell me if you think it's in the wrong direction.
No, but I'm not quite sure what direction it's in. I mean, my answer is probably, because everything for me starts on the yellow pad. And I think the shape actually, I think it took shape when I transcribed from the yellow pad to the computer. Mm. You know, when I started typing it out, all of a sudden I could move whole lines and phrases that, you know, weren't just repetitive one under the other, under the other, under the other, but all of a sudden the space came in, the definition of Hockett, the spasmodic or interrupted effect, helped me shape the words, you know, and there were those breaks, you know, and maybe it had something to do with the breathing exercises you all did, but there were, you know, I always looked where, for a space where I could, you know, breathe in the room and, you know, and then take my breath back. And so I think it probably, the shape of the piece, I think, formed on the computer, but the language formed on the pad.
Ooh, and it's true that certain of your pieces are highly notational, and you have glyphic notation such as arrows and markings, interspersed.
Do you mind actually explaining? So you had mentioned at the very end, or as a part of the last piece, the Nuisance Session X, there's this mention of this green valise, which I know is in some ways entwined with what these other kind of graphic marks. So, I mean, to give you a kind of picture of what we're holding in front of us also, and Ona will also introduce in a different way in a moment. It's a sequence of sessions of this kind in this almost translations from your yellow pad. And before it are a set of epigraphs, one which is "It's Jacinto," which we heard, other which is "It's Lydia Davies." And following those, or following each session is almost a kind of gift back. There's some, as Emma said, glyph or some kind of formal play with some kind of font when you don't really know, and sometimes a little remark underneath as if a bracketed translation maybe, or some annotation to that. So maybe like within the kind of story or the context of the story of the valise that you mentioned at the end, if you could speak towards those.
Well, maybe the first glyph is, refers to the money that he was always lending people, because every month he'd get his monthly check and everybody knew, and they would want to borrow from him. And when he wanted it back, which he rarely got, he was accused of being a loan shark, and he would come in and say, I'm not a loan shark. And so that didn't make it into the session, but it did make it into a drawing. And I just draw with the graphics on a computer. They're not, I mean, they're just, it's, you know, they're dollar signs and arrows, and, you know, one's going in one direction, the other's going in the other, and underneath it says, not a loan shark.
I like how those drawings relate to your sort of relationship with Jacinto, just on a formal level. That, I mean, letters, which of course are, in most settings, purposed very specifically as, you know, to bear this like communicative content. In your drawings, they kind of become communicative in a different way. Like Tim and I are always use this expression, communication by any means possible. It's just sort of using whatever is at hand to communicate an idea. And the way you describe diving in, or not diving in, but working your way into conversation with Jacinto by participating in his language and sort of feeling out the meanings there is very much sort of this communication by any means possible.
Or by particular means possible.
Yes, by particular means possible. He gives you the forms and you have to figure out with him what they mean. And also, maybe even show him what they mean sometimes.
Well, in the first segment, somebody said something about two things trying to coordinate around each other. And that's, I related totally to that. I felt like I was one thing and Jacinto was another. And we were just, constantly trying to coordinate around each other. And maybe that's what this is.
I mean, and to what you're both saying, and this kind of coordination using a particular language. But I think that there's some, I'm trying to kind of get to this in my head. There's some relationship to that, between that, I think, and using existent fonts, maybe, right? That like, this is not a drawing that you do in hand. It's as if, as I know, maybe with other work that you've done collaboratively with patients, like a barter to be, which will be, when is that screening? Do you want to say?
April 26th, but not yet.
Okay. but anyway, so in other work where you're collaborating, where it's as if the analyzed or the person that is being analyzed is the person that has the free hand of writing, where here you're still, you're using the fonts that are on, maybe that's making too much of these fonts, but it just reminds me of this one moment in Swimming with Jacinto, which is one of the last parts of Swimming in Space. Algorithms create our pace. Sometimes we just swim in place. He perseverates. I tread water. We repeat. Repetition creates order. In our process, we're never sure where or when our minds will flow. Only sure they come and go. I don't know. That's something that sort of comes to mind when we're thinking about those drawings also, and the use of a language or the reflection and repurposing of a language that is sound based and coming to mind.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that you made an agreement with Jacinto, sort of using this type of communication that you developed personally with him. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Well, in order to present the work, I needed to, get permission from the patient I was working with. It's, what we do in the field. And Jacinto wasn't keen on giving permission, but we ended up talking about it for a couple months and came to a place where we wrote our own form of permission. And he had a hand in writing what he was giving me permission for. And we went back and forth, and then we both signed it. I signed it to him, and he signed it to me.
I mean, I think that's really wonderful and speaks to me, at least to me, very much to what the reality of like language and relationships is. Because, I mean, I think there's something kind of perverse about traditional legal agreements as sort of creating, this language and arrangement of trust that is very impersonal. I mean, it's no coincidence to me that Latin is very often used in legal language. It's this language that's not meant to change. It's dead. It doesn't, there's no ambiguity anymore. It's like everything means, one thing. And I think that's sort of what legal language aspires to as this like unchanging structure that everyone has to come to.
All caps.
Yeah. Right.
And but then unfortunately where it gets really painful is that they not only aspire to that language, but they also aspire to the loopholes in the language, right, which can be really hurtful.
Interpretation, yes, as loopholes, yeah, right, in certain ways.
Exactly. And that there are all these problems with interpretation, and you know, maybe some of the issues that somebody who can't participate in these this type of language, at least in a decipherable way, like Jacinto, maybe that's, you know, just one of the many ways that they end up being labeled mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, maybe part of treatment is developing this sort of language of trust, or language that can be trusted in a personal relationship, rather than, you know, saying, you know, this is what the language is, you have to understand it and meet it,
mm-hmm,
or else there are going to be problems.
Yeah, it was the nature of our personal relationship that was binding, not the nature of, some outside words that we would sign on to. It was our words that we signed on to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's why I love that term algorithm, because it's like, and we might first associate it in some ways with something external, structured, impersonal, maybe more on the side of legalese, but here's something actually that is an algorithm. It's Jacinto's math, right? It's something that maybe ends up on your yellow pad, but as a means of communication with each other. Maybe that's a nice path into, because we haven't done it yet, if you want to read a part of the introduction, I think we have time for the introduction and some, and certainly another session, if that's all right.
Okay. Now that nobody knows what we're talking about, I'll read the introduction. The chaos that is Jacinto's world was reflected in my experience of pulling this presentation together. Notes upon notes, undated, unnumbered, windows open, breezes blowing, my yellow pages everywhere. Jacinto is an imposing figure, large, loud, and colorful. He wears hats of many stripes, sailor's caps, red berets, conductor hats with patent peaks, all of which he wears with style. I find a melancholy substance in his style. He is a vision of worn-out pride on parade, a parade of one with a lumbering gait and the weight of his world on his shoulders. Jacinto, in his mid-50s, is an unreliable historian. What has been recorded of his past is scant and conflicted. According to clinic records, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia in his teens. He got a job after high school as a grave digger, which he held for 18 years until he lost the job to what he says was the bulldozer. According to him, he had a nervous breakdown and was hospitalized for a year after that. He has since lived in an adult home on his own, in group homes, psychiatric hospitals, shelters, and supportive housing. When I began working with Jacinto, I saw him in weekly 45-minute psychotherapy sessions at an outpatient clinic. From the start, it was impossible to attend to an agenda in session with Jacinto, no matter how benign the agenda. He perseverates, he is noisy and repetitive, and I found myself thinking about Jacinto more often between sessions because it was too hard to think about anything in session with him. Too often, our sessions seem to unravel more than unfold. My refrain, like a mantra, had become, "Tell me something I don't know." In hopes of learning more about him, perhaps slowing him down as I reacted to his paranoid-tinged pounding that often dominated the sessions. Unable to find a pause in our session long enough to form a thought, at risk of fragmenting myself, I began, unbidden, in off hours and odd places, to organize the language of our chaotic sessions into verse. Using mostly his words, my pacing, and in effect, turning my experience of what I was doing as a therapist inside out. In the dissonance, I found rhythm and was able to jive with it, drawing me into, not pushing me away from our sessions. The blank, silent screen I unwittingly became a place where content was thinkable, and I composed myself with the rhythm and dark blues of Jacinto's spoken words. To hear the poetry in the clang, if you will, is what allowed me to survive as a therapist in the room with him. There was a kind of kindness between us that allowed us to form a bond of interchangeable vulnerability. This was how Jacinto and I came to know each other, not so much through understanding as through our kindness, which enabled an acceptance and trust. As our process developed, I hoped to find Jacinto taking interest in the kind of interest I took in him, to form a mutual interest in who, how, and what we were to each other, forging a relationship we both could return to. And he did return, even though I was never sure if he would show up for the next session. Always pleased he came to the last, and surprised by the occasional times he stopped by the clinic office to let me know he will be at our next session. I greeted this intrusion with mixed feelings of annoyance, relief, and delight, recognizing in these moments that he holds me in mind while making sure I hold him in mind in the time between our sessions. Here, I believed, lied hope. Jacinto likes things about me. Upon leaving a session, he turned to me and said, "When the sun shines, my heart is warm, and I think it is you." I like things about Jacinto. He is authentic, without artifice. I believe Jacinto believes what he says about himself, that he wants to be known simply as a nice person, that he is generous and doesn't want trouble, and what he says I see and believe about him. But he had difficulty using what he knows about himself productively, making it seemingly impossible for him to avoid the plaque and tangles of the chronic misunderstandings he finds himself embroiled in as he endeavors to know and be known, bringing to light how we all use, abuse, or abandon the knowledge we have of ourselves in the often confusing course of routine change that is everyday life.
Thank you, Anna. What that moment where you say, using mostly his words and my voice, to me is sort of mirroring of that, of also the last thing that you visit in that recollection and introduction at the same time, of speaking in some ways. And I'm curious of what you think about this term interdependence, or a kind of, or how you would characterize it, this, the way that he would come to, he wanted to keep you in mind, and he wanted you to keep him in mind, right? And, but literally in mind. And I don't know necessarily how to put it better, obviously, than you have already. But I'm wondering if you could connect that kind of relationship to what you say earlier, using mostly his words and my pacing, or his words, my pacing.
Who is the speaker? The level of speaking versus being spoken through, which I feel is connected to your question.
I don't know if this answers it, but you know, I think when I use his words, he can see himself in me. And that seems really important, because very few people take the time to see him. And so he knows I see him because I say him.
Right.
You know? And that was, I think it was a surprise to both of us. I mean, I had no idea I would ever get to that place with him. It was not something I preconceived. It was something that unfolded.
But it's also, in a big way, a comment on a general form of empathy, as you nod to at the end, of a way of realizing that there are, for everybody, in terms of, I mean, you put it almost rhythmically, right, that there's a way of misunderstanding the rhythms that surround us that make it difficult for us to feel extended towards each other, right? Or feel that one is extended towards us if we don't know we don't know which, it's not that we don't understand each other, we don't know what language to share.
Yeah, when we originally spoke about this, I was trying to say this, but didn't really know how to articulate it, but I feel like there's, when people think of psychotherapists, it's a, you know, they often have this image of some very rational minded and, you know, empirical approach to understanding this disorderly patient, and then this, you know, whatever's going on with the patient and whatever is wrong with them is sort of thought of, you know, in this scaffolding of scientific thought. And what interests me about and that sort of like contains the whatever's going on with the patient and sort of ends up just labeling it as mentally ill or other. You know, I feel like there are a lot of parallels to me with museums, but I won't go into that. And what interests me about your approach is that I think it required a huge amount of vulnerability, is that you had to sort of accept the possibility that whatever, you know, of whatever was going on Jacinto's mind when you were speaking with him, and you know what his patterns mean, and sort of adopting them, sort of meeting him halfway. I don't know, does that make sense?
Yeah, and an enormous curiosity and interest. You know, it's not to say that in training I didn't learn how to, you know, draw in the lines. You know, I mean, that was, you learn how to do this, and I think you have to learn how to do this before you know when you're, you know, moving out into your own form or direction.
Drawing the lines, you mean?
There is a science, and there is a lot of theory, and there's and it shouldn't be thrown away. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. One needs to know something about what they're doing. But they also need to allow themselves to be curious and creative, if they're going to find a way to energize the sessions or the experience.
Yeah. Well, that's a good case for funding the arts.
Absolutely.
Can we hear, we only have a couple minutes left. I'd love to, I don't know if we'll have time to do an exercise together. I hope that's not a big disappointment. But let's, I'd love to hear the barbershop.
Okay.
If I can. Session.
Session XYZ, the barber. They denied me. They denied Jacinto, barber training. They said, Jacinto, you have no social skills. Jacinto says, what is social skills? Men in jail cut hair. I don't steal. I don't lie. I talk loud, but I don't scream. I don't make trouble. They say, Jacinto, you don't have a diploma. They denied Jacinto barber training because I don't have a diploma. Men in jail cut hair. I want to cut my family's hair. I want to be a barber on the psychiatric ward and cut hair. I want to cut hair if they can't afford to pay. I have machines to cut hair. You clean them in Lysol. Can you help Jacinto cut hair? Jacinto, I say, can I help you find something else to do? If you can't cut hair, what else can you do? Jacinto says, buff floors, shampoo rugs, work off the books, keep the clinic clean. Jacinto comes to session with lots of information he wants to share. He shares his information with anyone who cares. Jacinto, I say, what do you know? He doesn't know what social skills are. Jacinto, I say, it's the way we talk and listen. Listen, Jacinto, I say. Jacinto talks but doesn't listen, responding without hearing. I spent 6 days in jail because they had the wrong guy. They don't listen. They said, Jacinto, you look like the guy. I said, I am not the guy. They had the wrong guy. I looked like the guy. They got the wrong guy. I got out. They didn't say sorry. Nobody said, sorry, Jacinto, we got the wrong guy. I say, Jacinto, they didn't have social skills. If they did, they would have said they were sorry. Jacinto says, sometimes in jail, a man makes a pass to another man. The man I passed outside your door winked at me as I passed by. I'm not homo. No, Jacinto is not gay. I gave him information about housing. He said he'd been in jail. Sometimes a man in jail makes a pass to another man. Yes, that is so, but you're not in jail. Maybe, Jacinto, maybe, I say, it was his way of saying thank you. Jacinto says, no, 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 no. Jacinto doesn't swing that way.
I wonder if just before you had mentioned this, which I think we're kind of circling around in different ways, the third person, and that's kind of maybe a skew from what we were talking about, but I'm just curious if you could describe that.
Well, Jacinto talks in the third person, and often that's considered very narcissistic or self-absorbed or detached from reality, but it also can be understood as a way to negotiate stress. I saw him as saying that. He was able to tell me what he was experiencing by feeling a little bit outside of the experience. Nevertheless, the experience was inside him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's what's so fascinating to me about this, his words, my pace, is that somehow in your writing of this, maybe you are also a part of that third person.
No question. I think that 1 + 1 = 3 in therapy and in many, many things. And, yes, what I couldn't have with... Jacinto and I both co-created the space we existed in for as long as we did at the clinic.
Great. Thank you, Ona.
Thank you.
Thank you, tongue in
cheek. Plural ones.
Thank you.
So we're here with Ona Lindquist, poet, psychoanalyst, writer, visual artist, and this was Tongue in Cheek Hockets. And we look forward to seeing you another time.
Ciao. Say,